30 issues in 30 days, issue 3, the post-Bush Constitution. 9/11 inspired in the Bush White House a very aggressive interpretation of executive powers, as you well know. They included, for example, surveillance programs without the usual warrants, signing statements that seemed to negate bills passed by Congress even as the president signed them, the power to hold terrorism suspects as detainees indefinitely without trial, even if they're acquitted at trial. In our 30 issues in 30 days listener voting process, you voted civil liberties the number 3 issue you wanted to address in this presidential election series. So here we are. We will begin with Adam Liptak. He has just taken over as Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times after the retirement of Linda Greenhouse after many years. Adam, welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you.
Adam, we're spending the entire first week of this series trying to get a hold on the state of our American democracy. So let's put that to you. It's a total softball question that you should be able to answer very briefly. What is the state of our Constitution in the year 2008, or at least how different is it from the year 2000?
Well, you've outlined already what really is the key issue, which is how much power do we want to give the president unilaterally in what the administration says is a time of war. And they have taken the view that at such a time, at least, they should have the power in secret and by themselves to do quite a few things. There has been substantial pushback from the Supreme Court insisting on a role for the other two branches, and rather less pushback from the remaining branch, the third branch, Congress, which has, when the administration has gone to it, essentially given it all of what it wanted, raising the question of why they didn't do that in the first place.
To what extent, then, has the hard wiring of the presidency changed? In other words, has the Bush administration been actually rewriting the code of executive power, or have they just been interpreting rules in a momentarily aggressive way?
Well, you know, all presidents, and particularly presidents in wartime, like to have a lot of power. So part of it is not a partisan Democratic-Republican issue. Part of it is that if you're in that office, you'd rather have more power than less. And presidents like Lincoln and FDR have made very broad claims of executive power. But the difference between those presidents and the Bush presidency is that those claims were typically made in public and debated in public, as Jack Goldsmith, the Bush administration lawyer, laid out in his book. The difference is that the Bush administration made its assertions more or less to itself rather than allowed them to be debated in the political process or litigated in the courts.
And how much do you think this has been kind of negotiated out now already in advance for the next president because of the fact that a Democratic Congress took over after the 2006 elections? Obviously, Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid and their caucuses have gone hard after some of the things that we were talking about, and there have been bills passed now with respect to treatment of detainees and with respect to the domestic surveillance that were not passed prior to 2006. So is this something that either Obama or McCain is going to have to face anew, this whole nexus of executive power, or has it kind of been hashed out?
Oh, I think there will be lots and lots of issues, and I think, interestingly, if the candidates are to be believed for statements they gave some months ago to my colleague Charlie Savage, then at the Boston Globe, now here at the New York Times' Washington Bureau, there's not all that much daylight between them. McCain told Charlie that the president has to follow whatever law Congress passes. McCain told Charlie that McCain will not sign so-called signing statements interpreting congressional enactments differently, perhaps, than what Congress wanted. Whereas, interestingly, Obama has reserved the right to employ signing statements.
Hmm. And as we get into some of those specifics from Charlie Savage's survey, both McCain and Obama spoke out pretty strongly against executive power when it came to surveillance. McCain said in January 2006, there are new challenges in the use of telecommunications that, in my view, indicate we probably need some enhanced powers. But why not just come to Congress? I know of no member of Congress, frankly, who, if the administration came and said, here's why we need this capability, that they wouldn't get it. And so let's have the hearings, said John McCain in 06. And Obama said in January of this year, quote, this administration has put forward a false choice between the liberties we cherish and the security we demand. The FISA court works. The separation of power works, unquote. But then, of course, both voted for granting retroactive immunity when it came to the telecom industries. So are both candidates starting to shift away from their earlier statements, perhaps in anticipation of being on the other side of this debate in the White House?
That's one way to look at it, but there's a second way, too. When you talk about executive power, you can mean two different things. One is unilateral executive power. What can the president do without Congress's blessing? That's the kind of executive power that critics of the Bush administration most object to. There's also executive power granted by Congress. And in that situation, there ought to be fewer objections because that's what the Constitution contemplates. So if Congress grants power and then the president uses that aggressively, we're in a different situation. You correctly point out, though, that retroactive immunity for the telecommunications companies does seem to cut in a different direction and does seem to, frustratingly, at least for reporters, seem to moot out the possibility that we'll get a final definitive answer from the courts about whether what the Bush administration did was constitutional or not.
We can take some phone calls for Adam Liptak, New York Times Supreme Court correspondent, on the issue of the executive powers, President Bush and the post-Bush Constitution as an issue for Obama and McCain with respect to what has changed since 2000, with respect to the positions of both of the candidates. We will be speaking in a few minutes to some other guests, one more of an advocate for Obama, one more of an advocate for McCain, talking about this whole nexus of civil liberties and executive power, one of the most requested segments by you when we had our voting for our 30 issues in 30 days segments. In fact, I want to read you one of those original comments from our website, which cuts right to the heart of the matter. Kate in Connecticut wrote, few presidents take office and then diminish the power they have. So I guess it remains to be seen, is either candidate willing to reduce or moderate this extreme power, writes Kate in Connecticut. And Adam, I guess maybe we can't even tell from anything they say on the campaign trail.
Well, a lot of it will depend on circumstances. A lot of it will depend on the political climate between the president and Congress, as you pointed out. So these things ebb and flow, and but you want to bear in mind that nobody lightly gives up power. They may not use the power, but they're not going to disclaim it.
McCain, and our phone number, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. In that Charlie Savage Boston Globe survey, McCain said he would close Guantanamo. Obama has said the same. McCain said he would not produce any signing statements. Obama said he would use them, but very sparingly. So where do you see the biggest differences between these two, since they seem, on the face of it at least, to be roughly similar? And are these sorts of comments on their part, more political posturing? But what about the differences, most of all, that you can tease out?
The key difference, really, is that Obama is a student of the Constitution, taught constitutional law, and the quality of his answers was, intellectually at least, more sophisticated and more nuanced. The John McCain answers are more visceral and decisive, so in that sense it gives you an insight into each man's approach to these issues.
Let's take a phone call. Here is Steve in Manhattan. Steve, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. This is more of a property right than a civil right, but I'm concerned about the movement of the Supreme Court in terms of eminent domain and the taking of private property for public, so-called public but also semi-private purposes. And I was wondering how the candidates, if they've even staked out positions, stand on those.
I don't know that the candidates have, but the decision you refer to from the Supreme Court a couple of years ago called Kelo was very, very unpopular. And both of the Supreme Court nominees since then, John Roberts and Samuel Alito, indicated at their confirmation hearings that they were uncomfortable with that decision. So I think it's an almost universally held view, and I'd be surprised if McCain and Obama would take a different position, that broad eminent domain powers are quite politically unpopular.
Well, that's reassuring. Thanks.
Steve, thank you. Although certainly when we talk about the broadest interpretation of the title of this segment, the post-Bush Constitution, it would have a lot more than executive powers and civil liberties in it. Whether it's privacy and Roe v. Wade mm-hmm. or affirmative action as yes. interpreted constitutionally or whatever, which brings us to the fact that hardly needs being discussed because we know they are so different on this. The matter of Supreme Court nominees is so crucial to what the future of the country is going to be like. And Obama has stated very simply that he would appoint Supreme Court justices like Breyer and Ginsburg. And McCain has stated very simply that he would appoint ones like Scalia and Alito. So on we go from there.
It's a closely balanced court, and that is, you're quite right to say that that's a crucial issue in this election. We may well have a very different court 2, 3, 4 years from now, depending on who's elected.
And the oldest members of the court are, by and large, the more liberal members, aren't they?
The older members and the members about whom, third-hand scuttlebutt says are the most likely to retire are all of them liberals, which means that if you have an Obama presidency, you might get a one-for-one switch ideologically without a recasting of the ideological composition.
That would just hold the court in the rough balance that it's got right now.
Yes, although with one important exception that John Paul Stevens, the most senior member of the court, is such a savvy operator in the court, and because of his seniority gets the right to assign opinions when he's in the majority. Losing Stevens even to a very capable, ideologically similar, more junior justice will be a setback to the liberal wing.
Hmm. Whereas if McCain is elected and Stevens and maybe Ginsburg, who's 74, retire during his administration, then the court would shift presumably more to the right because he'd have the opportunity to make those not one-for-one swaps, but, one not like-for-like swaps, but like-for-dislike.
Exactly right. So the short of it is if McCain is elected and we have resignations, you'll have a different court. If Obama is elected and we have resignations, we'll have a similar court.
Pete, in Westwood, you're on WNYC with New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Leptak. Hello.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about signing statements and whether the court will weigh in, if there are any cases that are working their way to the court on signing statements.
There are no cases on their way, and it's a little hard to envision exactly how one would work. After all, a signing statement by itself does nothing. Just as legislative history, which is to say, if a bill is passed and some congressperson stands up and says, here's what I think it means, that by itself does nothing. So in some sense, signing statements and legislative history are atmospheric only, and unless you can show that the president, in addition to saying, here's how I interpret the law, actually then went and violated it in some fundamental way, it's hard to imagine how the case comes forward.
Is it possible then, to do a blanket for Obama or McCain to come in and say those signing statements didn't matter and we're not going to follow them?
Oh, absolutely, sure. A signing statement in a way, there's a long history of them. It goes back to Andrew Jackson. Lots and lots of presidents have used them. In a way, it's an instruction to your subordinates. You get an ambiguous piece of legislation and you tell your subordinates, here's how I think you should implement it. In that sense, that's uncontroversial. The Bush administration, though, in volume and in the scope of authority it claimed for itself, was radically different from earlier administrations.
All right. Pete, thank you for your call. By the way, on what kind of justices John McCain would appoint and on his view of the Constitution generally and the malleableness or lack thereof of the Constitution, here is an exchange between McCain and Whoopi Goldberg on ABC's The View earlier this month.
Yes, sir, can you just, yes. I don't want to misinterpret what you're saying. Did you say you wanted strict constitutionalists? Because
No, I want people who interpret the Constitution of the United States the way our founding fathers envisioned for them to do.
Should I be worried about being a slave, being returned to slavery? Because certain things happened in the Constitution that you had to change.
So that, you know, she's being funny, but she's not there, Adam, right? When you talk about trying to have things exactly the way the founding fathers laid them out in the Constitution, I guess she's, you know, she's making a point that, yes, slavery was in the Constitution. It was taken out of the Constitution. But it's a view, you know, I guess, on how justices interpret for the times or for something that's considered more timeless.
Right. Well, you could, the lawyer in me wants to object to her statement because the 14th Amendment did change things, and we care about what the framers of the 14th Amendment thought, just as originalists care about what the framers of the original Constitution thought. But the broader point is that you can look at the Constitution in one of two ways. You can look at it as a kind of standard issue contract, legal document that needs to be interpreted through ordinary principles of legal interpretation, you know, like a co-op deal. Or you can look at it as a document meant to live through the ages with broad, open-textured clauses in them like due process and equal protection of law and freedom of speech that some of the justices say ought to be interpreted in light of evolving circumstances.
I never did think of the Constitution much like a co-op deal. So you've given me an entirely new framing there, even if in opposition. You recently wrote a series about the effect of our Constitution abroad and how other countries are perhaps looking to our Constitution and our courts less and less as a model than they used to. That was such a fascinating series of articles. Is this a big concern for either McCain or Obama, the fact that other countries are now not citing U.S. law as a model for the judicial arm of democracy?
I don't know the specific answer to that, but both of them have you see in both of them some impulse to care about the international community, to care about international agreements, the Geneva Conventions, and so on. Obama, of course, has lived abroad. McCain has, so has McCain, obviously. So they both of them seem to have seem to want to have America have a place in the world in a way that perhaps the George Bush administration did not.
Rosemary in Princeton, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. I was glad to hear that the winner or one of the most popular topics was this question of the Constitution and sort of repairing it. And I may be...
So alternative energy was number one. Health insurance reform was number two. And civil liberty / executive power was number three.
Good. I'm still pleased. My question is this. You know, looking at this whole issue of executive overreaching and whether Obama or McCain, you know, what their responses might be in terms of what we've seen in the last 7 or 8 years now, it seems to me that the larger question really is the Congress, which is supposed to be the check on that power, willing to exercise its power? Because we saw in 2006 when the Democrats were returned to a majority based on ending the war, the first thing they did was, take impeachment off the table, which is a non-incentive for people to behave. And secondly, they have, you know, funded this war now for 5 years. So my question is in terms of a future president, how might that dynamic play out?
And let me just say that with respect to accountability, we're going to have a guest later in the hour looking at exactly that question. How will the next president and the next Congress still digest what some people think are impeachable crimes on the part of President Bush and Vice President Cheney? Does that whole debate about accountability, even short of impeachment, which would of course become moot, just stop because the administration has changed, or does it go on in some way in Congress? And we'll look at that question with another guest later in the hour. But briefly, Adam Liptak, to Rosemary's question.
As to what the next Congress does, again, it will depend on the dynamic between whoever the new president is and the political climate and the circumstances in the war and how scared people are of terrorism. There's so many factors that it's really hard to predict.
Do you expect, then, before we go on to Lawrence Tribe, for Obama and another guest who's pro McCain. Do you expect these sorts of questions with respect to executive power, signing statements, treatment of detainees, the other things we've been discussing this hour? Do you expect these sorts of questions to come up in the debates or in the home stretch of the campaign between Obama and McCain? Because I'll tell you, we went through their convention speeches and neither of them mentioned this stuff.
I sure hope they do. I find them fascinating and important, and they've not taken a large part in the campaign. You know, there was that offhand comment Sarah Palin made in her acceptance speech that Obama wants to read terrorists their rights. But aside from that, I didn't hear much of anything either, aside from a sort of a joke.
All right. Adam Liptak, now the Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Lawrence Tribe next as we continue with 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 3, the Post-Bush Constitution.
Because you will have elected a president who has taught the Constitution and believes in the Constitution and will obey the Constitution of the United States of America.
Barack Obama saying that he will obey the Constitution because he has taught the Constitution. Well, who taught Barack Obama the Constitution? Our next guest, Lawrence Tribe, constitutional scholar at Harvard. He was Barack Obama's professor, or one of them, at Harvard Law, and he has referred to Obama as, quote, the best student I ever had. He's also advising the Obama campaign on these matters, and he joins us now. Professor Tribe, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
My pleasure to join you.
Let me start with that quote. Obama claims he will obey and preserve the Constitution. That's a very big statement. What does it mean to you specifically?
Oh, it's clear, and it has been ever since Barack Obama was both my research assistant and a student in my constitutional law course, that for him the Constitution is not simply an intriguing document, but it's a living, breathing source of wisdom as well as constraint. It's something that he's dedicated to, that he loves, that he understands deeply, and unlike the current president, and I think unlike Senator McCain, he doesn't regard the Constitution as simply an inconvenience or an obstacle to be tripped over or to be stepped on.
Well, I'm sure McCain would say that he doesn't either. But is it reasonable to think that on these questions of executive power that we've been dwelling on mostly this hour, that President Obama would actively cut back his own powers, or is it inevitable that any president looks to preserve and expand executive power once they're in office? We saw, for example, his reversal on the FISA bill as that actually came up before a vote.
But, you know, it's important with respect to something like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act to recognize that Barack Obama maintained the central position that the president does not have the power to engage in electronic eavesdropping in violation of an act of Congress. He was disappointed by the precise terms of the act of Congress that was adopted as a compromise measure, and he didn't want to see immunity granted retroactively to the telephone companies, but he thought that was a price worth paying to get some congressional restraint. But on that very issue, it's a good example of where Obama and McCain differ. McCain, of course, says he would obey the Constitution, but when Bush came to shove, he said he agreed that President Bush had the right, despite a congressional prohibition in FISA, to go ahead and engage in eavesdropping because the commander-in-chief has inherent powers that even Congress cannot limit. That kind of notion that because the president is commander-in-chief of the military, he is essentially commander-in-chief of the country, is one that Barack simply rejects right to the depth of his soul. And I think that although I suppose you could say that anyone seeks self-aggrandizement, there's every indication in Barack Obama's career that he would regard the idea of an unchecked and unfettered president to be anathema.
In the Boston Globe candidate survey, which we've referred to a few times and which we've now posted on our webpage, so listeners, if you want to actually see what McCain and Obama said when the Boston Globe asked about these issues. We have linked to that material at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. McCain pledged not to use any signing statements at all, those things that President Bush was fond of that seemed to negate bills passed by Congress even as he was signing them, whereas Obama pointed out that many presidents used them before Bush and that he would reserve the right to use them, although he would try to use them sparingly. Is that surprising to you that Obama would say yes to signing statements while McCain would say no?
Not at all. It shows that Obama understands the Constitution and McCain was simply trying to score a point. The reason is that signing statements are an indispensable tool of presidential administration of the law. When Congress passes a law that is ambiguous or that might be fine in general but might have some particular application that would violate someone's constitutional rights, it's been a traditional and important step for the president to be transparent by saying upon signing the law how he understands its ambiguity and in what circumstances he would test its constitutionality by not adhering to some demand that it makes of him. And when McCain said, oh, I won't use signing statements, it's quite obvious that he didn't understand the structure of the way the executive and legislative branches interact and was simply trying to score a point.
But he's he's got a promise to keep now, John McCain, if he is elected president, and that is no signing statements ever.
It's a promise that would make the executive branch utterly opaque, because what it means is that if Congress passes a law that has ambiguities, and I've never seen a law that didn't, the president would not be able to indicate to the country how he intends to instruct the executive branch with respect to those ambiguities. It seems to me that it's a promise he will either break or keep to the regret of the whole country.
So you think signing statements do actually have a positive purpose?
Absolutely, as long as they're not used the way George Bush used them to trample constitutional restraints on presidential overreaching.
Is there anything else where in the kinds of issues we've been discussing, wiretapping, Guantanamo, detainees in general, signing statements, where you think Obama distinguishes himself in addition to what we were just discussing from McCain, because they do both give very similar answers to a lot of the questions in the Boston Globe survey?
There's one fundamental difference that's more recent than that Boston Globe survey, and it relates to habeas corpus, the basic right of people that we might lock up perhaps indefinitely to have some neutral trier of fact, a judge or someone like a judge, decide whether they are perhaps being held without cause, the right to habeas corpus. And when the United States Supreme Court affirmed that right this summer for people in Guantanamo by a vote of 5-4, a vote that would have come out differently under a McCain court if Justice Stevens were replaced by someone like Justice Scalia, the McCain reaction to that fundamental decision, a great triumph for civil liberties, was, and I quote him, that it was one of, quote, the worst decisions, unquote, in the nation's history. And, of course, that made me reel, and it didn't please Barack Obama, who recognized that what that means is that John McCain puts decisions protecting the rights of people not simply to be locked up indefinitely and to protect their rights, puts a decision to protect their rights down there in the same category as Dred Scott entrenching slavery or Plessy v. Ferguson upholding the segregation of the races. There's a radical difference.
So the habeas corpus, I just want to make sure that we're framing this right. This question of whether the detainees have a right to habeas corpus, Obama is for it and McCain is against it.
Absolutely. Obama is for giving those basic rights to detainees, not the rights that Sarah Palin joked about, some fancy Miranda warning on the battlefield, something that neither Barack Obama nor John McCain nor any sane person would advocate, but the basic right to have someone decide whether you're being locked up for no good reason.
Ralph in Hoboken, you're on WNYC with Lawrence Tribe. Hello.
Oh, genius. Mr. Tribe, I just wanted to say you're like one of my heroes. I've read so
Thank
much
you,
of
Ralph.
Your work in law school. It's such a pleasure to actually get to talk to you. My question has nothing to do with the topic. It's simply this. Is it true that when you go to the Supreme Court for oral argument, you actually load your briefcase with quivers so they overflow when you open it before you start your argument?
No, it's not true. But I have taken a little toy seal from my daughter and hidden it in the briefcase for good luck.
Oh, that's brilliant. At least I know something. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Ralph. Thank you very much. We're going to go on to another guest with some other views, Eric Posner, in just a minute. But To what extent, Lawrence Tribe, has Obama's work with you when he studied constitutional law with you at Harvard, and then his teaching of constitutional law, to what extent do you think that has affected his view of these questions? I mean, one of the things that he's fighting on the campaign trail is the sense that he tends to be sometimes professorial and abstract and theoretical. Does it help to ground him in real rights and responsibilities and the kinds of things that are going to make this country better? Or is there almost a downside to studying constitutional law before you go into active practice as chief executive?
Constitutional law is not just some ethereal, theoretical thing. It's about real people's real rights. And I must say, when Barack Obama was studying that subject with me, I learned from him as well as teaching him. He had had already some experience with people's problems in areas of Chicago where their jobs had been lost and where they were being mistreated and discriminated against. He brought a sense of realism and pragmatism to my understanding of constitutional law. And one of the things that informs me is that I deal with real people in real cases and not only with abstract writing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just a bum rap to think that Barack, simply because he loves explaining things, is too professorial. He's down to earth.
So one piece of advice, or how about your top wish list item, if your student does become the next president of the United States, with respect to the Constitution, that you would like him to do? Anything that he could either propose as a bill or do unilaterally as an executive order, other than a Supreme Court nominee?
Oh, he has his own list, and it's really quite powerful. He wants to close Guantanamo because he recognizes, as did Bill Clinton at the convention, that the power of our example nationally and internationally is a lot stronger than the example of our power. He wants to restore habeas corpus. He wants to respect the constitutional independence of the judiciary rather than trashing independent judges. He wants judges who will apply the Constitution in the living way that its framers intended rather than as a frozen document. It's going to be a bright new day, I think. And the person who swears him in will be another student of mine, another former student, John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the United States.
I guess we'll have to get together again and find out how you think that student is doing, though it might be a little different conversation. Lawrence Tribe, Harvard Law Professor, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
We must fight the terrorists and at the same time defend the rights that are the foundation of our society. We can't torture or treat inhumanely suspected terrorists we have captured. I believe we should close Guantanamo.
John McCain pledging to close Guantanamo as well and strike a balance between fighting terrorism and defending constitutional rights. Joining us now to talk about further about how McCain and Obama may find that balance is Eric Posner, a law professor at the University of Chicago, visiting professor at NYU right now this fall, and author of Terror in the Balance, Security, Liberty, and the Courts. He's written papers with John Yoo, the author of the so-called torture memos in the Bush administration, as well as a general intellectual force behind Bush administration thinking on the Constitution. And yet Eric Posner has also been critical of some of the executive overreach of the last 8 years. Professor Posner, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Nice to be here. Thank you.
Let's start with that McCain quote that we just heard. He pledges to close Guantanamo, something Obama has also pledged. You wrote a 2006 op-ed in the New York Times defending the detention of prisoners at Guantanamo Bay. What do you make of McCain pledging to close it?
Well, it's clearly Guantanamo Bay has clearly become a problem for the United States, and it's probably sensible to close it. It's become a symbol of many of the things that people don't like about the United States. But what I do think is that the problem of detaining suspected members of al-Qaeda will continue. And I suspect that the next president, whether it's McCain or Obama, will continue to authorize American forces to detain people. They have to detain people, for example, who they pick up in Afghanistan in the midst of a military conflict. That's a normal aspect of war. And the problem has always been that members of al-Qaeda, it's not really clear whether to think of them as criminals or as enemy soldiers. But as a practical matter, I think that when these people are picked up in battlefield conditions, it'll be necessary to detain them. It may not be necessary to detain them as long as has been done in the past, but some kind of detention policy will continue.
Well, I guess the constitutional question with respect to Guantanamo Bay is that because Guantanamo Bay is technically located outside the United States, it gave the administration more leeway with respect to what kinds of rules they were treated under. Is that correct?
That was the administration's argument, but it appears that the Supreme Court doesn't agree with that argument and is pushing back against it.
Has that been totally refuted now? There's nothing that they can do with the detainees at Guantanamo that they couldn't do if they were in Florida?
It's not entirely clear. They may have a certain amount of flexibility because even after the recent Boumediene case, the court made clear that when dealing with serious security problems and logistical problems, the courts will use some kind of balancing test. So one possibility is that Guantanamo Bay will just be like Florida because it's nearby and it may not be any more difficult to detain people there or treat them well than in Florida. But the obvious response of the administration will be to detain people overseas, I assume, in places like Afghanistan, to the extent that they feel that it's necessary to do so. They may feel that it's not necessary to do so, but, of course, that's a policy issue rather than a legal issue.
So just to put you in a little context for our listeners, is it safe to say that you're part of a group of conservative scholars, along with maybe Jack Goldsmith and Charles Fried, who started to break with some of the more aggressive moves on the part of the Bush administration?
I don't know how accurate that is. I've long supported the general idea that during an emergency and after an emergency, the executive should have more discretion than during normal times, and that courts should be more deferential than they should be during normal times.
So now 7 years after 9/11, we still in an emergency?
Well, it's not clear. That makes it hard. The administration made a number of legal arguments that were very aggressive, and I've never endorsed these particular legal arguments. Some of them are more persuasive than others. I'm more interested in the general theoretical question. I thought that the criticism of the Bush administration in the years after 9/11 was excessive and hasty. But your question is a good one. At some point, it's no longer realistic to say that we're in a situation of emergency or crisis, and the normal rules have to be reinstated. The problem here is that al-Qaeda remains a dangerous force. And trying to figure out what exactly should be the rules, one that balance concerns about security and liberty, civil liberties, is extremely difficult.
How do you see the biggest differences between McCain and Obama on the kinds of issues we've been talking about so far? Because they both do tend to say similar things, with the big exception, as Lawrence Tribe pointed out, of habeas corpus rights for the detainees.
I don't think there's going to be any difference between the two of them. That is, whatever they might say now, and as you point out, they don't say anything very different. Whoever becomes president will probably not act that differently with respect to security issues. Because I think there's more or less a consensus about what needs to be done, and then there's just a disagreement about the details. So the president will want maximum discretion. Obama may, want to use his discretion in slightly different ways from the way McCain does. Obama might think that, for example, there should be more military forces in Afghanistan or fewer. We're not sure at this point. But they'll both want as much freedom of action so that if things change, if there's a new challenge or crisis, they'll be free to act as is necessary and as people will expect them to act. They don't want to have to go to Congress for authority. unless they absolutely have to. And so, like Bush, they're going to interpret their statutory authority as broadly as possible, and they're going to make aggressive arguments about their constitutional powers, which virtually every president has done. Certainly, for example, Bill Clinton did during the during his two administrations. And, you know, people have forgotten that Clinton, in a way, acted even more aggressively than Bush did. He authorized the military intervention in Serbia in 1999 without congressional authorization. In fact, in the face of congressional opposition, there was a vote which he did not win. So he did that. It was probably a good policy decision, and so no real legal consequences followed. Obama, I think, will act like Clinton when he's the president. The Justice Department will advise him that he has authorities beyond those that he's claimed in the past in the presidential campaign. And when he'll have to ask himself, well, if the Justice Department says that I have these authorities, am I just going to disagree with them and act passively when there's this serious challenge that's facing us? I just don't believe that he would do that. He's too much of a practical, pragmatic person to allow you know, possible theories about the constitutional power of the presidency to get in the way of acting in a sensible way.
Let's take a phone call. Doug in Millburn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thanks, Brian, for your ongoing lifeline to sanity. It's only on your show that I could call and want to ask a question of Adam Liptak. Think I'm going to ask Professor Tribe, and here I am with Professor Posner.
Sorry it took so long. Go ahead.
That's okay. I'm thrilled. And my question is about extraordinary rendition, and what specific statements or positions has McCain taken on extraordinary rendition?
I don't know the answer to that question. All that I can say is that the practice goes back to the Clinton administration. The Bush administration engaged in this practice much more aggressively. So the Justice Department has a longstanding view that it's lawful. Others have criticized it for violating various international treaties. I don't know the explicit views of the candidates on these things. I would be surprised if the practice stopped if either of them became president.
Before you go, any advice to McCain in particular on how much he should distance himself from the Bush administration on questions of executive power and how much he should refrain from doing so? Because in the Boston Globe survey, with the questions answered by both McCain and Obama that we've been talking about this hour, McCain refuses to answer the question, is there any executive power the Bush administration has claimed or exercised that you think is unconstitutional? He doesn't answer that. He refused to answer that question, though he responded to the rest of the survey. Would that be a particularly bad idea, in your opinion?
Yeah, here's the problem that the Bush administration, when it makes these claims about executive power, it cites precedents from earlier administrations. It's not making all of this up. What it's done that has troubled people is it's taken old theories that the executive has always advanced and extended them. So it'd be very difficult for someone responsibly, I think, someone who wants to become president, to say, well, I disagree with these old theories. I think that McCain and Obama, and I think Obama, I'm going to give some advice to Obama as well. I think what they have to do is they have to distance themselves from the Bush administration, but they don't want to tie their hands by repudiating broad executive power. I don't think people really want that. I don't think the public really wants that. And then once they're president, they're going to realize that they'll need as much power as they can in order to accomplish what they think is necessary. What will happen is that Congress, well, what might happen is that Congress or the court will push back, and that those are really the sources of the limitations on the president's power.
Eric.
But I don't think that they should, that they should repudiate these old theories about executive power.
Eric Posner, law professor at the University of Chicago, visiting this fall at NYU, and author of Terror in the Balance, Security, Liberty, and the Courts. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And we will ask the question, how much should the next president hold the previous president, President Bush, accountable for any constitutional excesses that he may have been responsible for. Stay with us.
They have violated the Constitution. They took us into a war based on lies. Why should they be exempted from U.S. law, international law, and the requirements of the Constitution?
Dennis Kucinich, congressman and former presidential candidate, when I spoke to him at the Democratic convention on his continued efforts to impeach President Bush and Vice President Cheney. This is 30 Issues in 30 Days, our presidential election series, Issue 3, the post-Bush Constitution. And we're going to spend this last little bit of today's discussion on the question of accountability for what some, like Kucinich, see as violations of the Constitution. As it happens, Bush administration accountability was another one of the highest vote-getters when we asked you, our listeners, to choose our final 30 issues. So here we go. You asked for it with Elizabeth Holtzman, former congresswoman and author of The Impeachment of George W. Bush. You can probably gather where she stands on this issue. She came on to talk about the Bush, the book when it came out. And Elizabeth Holtzman, welcome back to WNYC. Is there a realistic expectation that the next president, once Bush is out of office and the impeachment question becomes moot, that the next president or the next Congress can deal with any of these issues?
I think there will be some effort to hold the president accountable. I would say, given the extraordinary financial crisis that we're in, if we're still in the middle of that, that's probably going to be dominating the news, also efforts to deal with the serious economic problems that we have. But I still believe that adhering to the Constitution is central to all of this, because we don't have a democracy and we don't have the system that we cherish unless our Constitution is functioning properly.
So what hearings
so
would you...
I do believe that, for example, there are a few things that need to be done. Whether they will start in the next, they probably should be started in the next administration. First, there needs to be a very serious effort to find out what happened and what went wrong. President Bush has claimed executive privilege, in my view, completely inappropriately with regard to the U.S. attorney scandal, with regard still to the what he knew and when he knew it, with regard to the deceptions about the war, a full investigation about what happened with regard to torture, the wiretapping, and so forth. So I think there needs to be an inquiry into what happened and what went wrong. With regard to punishment and accountability, I think there are two ways to deal with that. One is, of course, through the criminal laws. Some of what President Bush and his team did were crimes. And theoretically, potentially crimes. I don't mean they were crimes. I mean they're potentially crimes. I misspoke. They are potentially crimes and are subject to prosecution under the U.S. statutes.
What most specifically?
Well, for example, the anti-torture statute makes it a U.S. crime, and it carries the death penalty if death results to subject a person to torture. That's one of the reasons that the Bush administration has persistently said we don't do torture, because if they said we do torture, they'd be committing a U.S. crime, a felony, which carries the death penalty when death results. And we do know that death did result from some of the mistreatment of detainees. So if you want to make the assumption somebody ordered the torture, we know that waterboarding, for example, was approved at the highest levels of our government. If it's determined that waterboarding is torture, then theoretically you have a prosecution. And when you have a death penalty, by the way, Brian, you have no statute of limitations, which means that even if this administration, the upcoming administration, whatever it is, decides not to prosecute, the statute of limitations will not run for the person's lifetime.
So you think that the appointment of the next attorney general, for example, or that whoever is the next attorney general is going to have to confront this question of whether to go after any of this legally?
Absolutely. That's right. Absolutely. And indeed, one of the things that the Bush administration did, because they figured they could get around the Anti-Torture Act, because they could say, well, waterboarding, that's not torture. We didn't ever order torture. We don't do torture. They tried to get out of it by definitional approach. But the War Crimes Act of 1996 presented a huge problem to them, and they were quite panicked about it. And as because that doesn't apply just to torture, it applies to cruel and inhuman treatment. And so everything they were doing falls within that: waterboarding, stress positions, heat and cold, loud noise, and so forth. And again, if death results, is a death penalty. They were so upset about that and possible prosecution under that statute that they slipped into the Military Commissions Act a provision making that statute retroactively inoperative. Mm.
So in our last 20 seconds, do you have any indication that Obama is any more inclined to have his Justice Department pursue any of these things criminally than McCain would be?
I don't know. I have no indication. But, you know, there is a concern about justice. If crimes are committed, do we have a dual standard justice in this country? One for high officials who can commit crimes and get away with it, and one for everything else, everybody else? I don't think so. So there will be pressure. There will be conversation. There will be discussion about how and whether to hold these people
liable. To leave it. Former Congresswoman from New York, Elizabeth Holtzman, author of The Impeachment of George W. Bush, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's 30 Issues in 30 Days, Issue 2, the Post-Bush Constitution. Tomorrow, that's Issue 3. Tomorrow, Issue 4 is Extreme Partisanship Destroying Our Democracy.